Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello there, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Chris Patterson, a co-host of the network, and my guest today is Lily Wong, who is an assistant professor of literature at the American University in Washington, D.C., and whose work has appeared in American Quarterly, Journal of Chinese Cinemas, Asian Cinema, and Asian American Literary Review. We'll discuss her smashing new book, Trans-Pacific Attachments, Sex Work, Media Networks, and Effective Histories of Chinese-ness, which was published by Columbia University Press of this year. Trans-Pacific Attachments traces the genealogy of the Chinese sex worker as a figure who manifests throughout the 20th century in moments of anti-Asian racism as well as moments of sexism and nationalism within Chinese communities. Yet for Wong, the tensions and visibility of this figure also allow alternative and alternating forms of solidarity rooted in stepping back from ideologies of nation, race, and gender. The sex worker thus allows us to see Chinese-ness and other forms of collectivity as an effective product, an attachment that mobilizes our emotions and frames how we see others as well as ourselves. By charting representations of the Chinese sex worker through histories of Pacific Crossing, Cold War-era ideologies, and contemporary states of neoliberalism, Wong's book shows the multiple ways that sex work and prostitution have unsettled forms of collectivity while providing new spaces for dwelling. So with that, let's meet the author. Lily, thanks so much for coming on the show. Would you like to begin by telling us more about yourself?
Wonderful. Thank you, Chris, for having me on. What Chris said, I am an assistant professor at AU. My research focuses mainly on the politics of affect and emotion, gender and sexuality, comparative race, and media formations of Trans-Pacific Chinese, Sinophone, and Asian American communities. And Trans-Pacific Attachments is my first book, so I'm excited to talk more about it.
Great. So let's get right to it. Then you begin the book with an anecdote about the funeral for Li Jun, a sex worker in Taiwan who supported her family all her life and who helped run the collective of sex workers and supporters at a famous working class brothel. Why begin with this story to open a book about trans-Pacific attachments and affects?
Right. So Li Jun's story, along with Guan Jie, who is another sex worker and activist that I write a little bit about in the book as well, their stories played a very large role in shaping my understanding of collective intimacy from an early age. So collective intimacy in terms of the family, the nation, and what constitutes the global. While this had a lot to do with my parents, they were academics and labor rights advocates. And when they returned to Taiwan from the U.S. in the early 1990s, they organized alongside Li Jun and Guan Jie at CASWAS, the Sex Worker Rights Collective, also known as Zhuzhichun. So they engaged in a lot of protests and rallies that exposed me to the relationship between state power, the policing of social morality, and the limits of global mobility. And so in a way, the book project started off as an attempt to extend the labor rights work that I witnessed and really admired. And the book takes on a more cultural perspective. It traces the symbolic and discursive work done by the sex work figure, both in real life and through cultural presentation. And since my parents were both psychologists, I feel like my choice of using affect as a mode of analysis in part. And of course, there's other reasons which we can go into later with methodology. In part, my use of affect was a way to connect their emphasis on the psychology of emotions with a more cultural studies focus on affect through the circulation of text, and then to further extend that scope into a larger trans-Pacific scale.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you begin with this story. For me, who has lived in like Hong Kong and mainland China, where especially for queer like folk, Taiwan is kind of this, seen as this haven.
Right.
You know, where like men and women are equal. It's totally tolerant of any kind of queer communities. So it has this reputation, right? Mm-hmm. And so like one thing I got from that example immediately is that, you know, first of all, this reputation is part of the way the state has chosen to kind of represent itself. And then the other hand is that a lot of the good things that Taiwan has have come along because of all of this activism from sex workers who continue to be controversial, I guess, to say the least. So I guess that kind of brings us to the figure of the sex worker. And just to make it clear to the audience that we are talking about the figures, the representations, the characters, but it's still very important, right? What is it about this figure of the sex worker? Why is she or he important when considering, as you do, conceptions of nation, happiness, the family, stability, or modernity?
Yeah, absolutely. So the figure of the sex worker, if you think of it, marks the intersection of margins of sexual, cultural, and class structures, oftentimes at the same time. And the Chinese sex worker in particular has had a long history of operating as a trope of both Asian American sexuality and Asian modernity throughout the 20th and 21st century. And so I kind of map that history itself. And even though the book starts with the Taiwan case, right? Even in the case of the Taiwanese sex worker, we see the ghost of Chineseness kind of affecting the workers' bodies and profession. Of course, this is also furthered by stereotypical perceptions that mainland Chinese migrants pose sexual, moral, and political threats to the Taiwanese state, very similar to the Yellow Peril narrative that we see in the early 20th century in the U.S. And see that shifting international conceptions of what China is or what Chineseness constitutes affects these Taiwanese sex workers' livelihood. And they operate as particularly sticky forms of cultural imagination. Here I'm using kind of Sarah Mid's idea. And that kind of sticky form then operates in constituting what we understand as kinship, family, and nation. And so the book tries to historicize those sticky moments. And in a way, then, the way I track these sticky moments is to kind of understand the sex worker figure as an affect of labor in their own right.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about affect too. And I love the word, because you continue to use that word throughout the book, the stickiness of some of like Chineseness and the attachments, right, that people have. And I like that you talk about Chineseness also less as a kind of national identity and more as an affective attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a bit about, you know, your use of affect in that way and you know, what do you mean exactly by this? How does the process become sticky?
Right, absolutely. So I read affect as a politics of emotional mobilization, the power to move and be moved by others, right? And so that sticky moment oftentimes motivates a certain kind of collective engagement, right? And so affect scholars have long had this long debate between what is affect, what is emotion, are they the same, are they different, do they come, what does one come before the other? And so I kind of detail this whole debate in the book quite a bit, but just to be clear how I use affect in the book, I use it as a way to build off of a very particular genealogy of post-colonial and women of color scholarship. That sees affect and emotions as intricately tied processes that are not outside of social constructions of, say, race and sex and gender formations. That it is a sense of relationships between bodies that form collectives that mobilize relationships to social norms, basically. And so here I'm building off of the work of Sarah Hamid, Li Xie, Claire Hemmings, just to name a few. And so drawing from their work, I read affect as not private expressions, but as public practices that are potentially ways to reorder our individual relationships to what we consider the social. So in other words, I don't study what affect or emotions are. I look at what they do, right? I don't see affect as a particularly individuated or universal state. I see it as a historically specific cultural and social practice that has material consequences to them. And so to read the sex worker as an affective labor of Chinese-ness, I then approach the figure as a cultural medium that historically allows for various ideas of collectivity or collective engagements to take shape, but also have the potential to reshape itself constantly.
Yeah, I like this. I like this approach. And at first, I was confused a bit because I think when you talk about affect, you talk about it as a way of like seeing emotion mobilized.
Yeah.
And just when I see those two words in the same definition, affect and emotion, I'm like, oh, I have a hard time. But then
right.
I realized, you know, that definition you give also forces us to include others or the other, right? Because you say that you define affect as a mobilization of emotion, but of also of moving and being moved by others.
Yeah.
So this kind of necessitates these figures, like you said, the affective laborers, mm-hmm. like the figures of the sex workers. So I like that a lot. The last frameworky question I wanted to ask you is about that word that appears in the subtitle of my book, but in the actual title of your book, which is this framework that we've been calling the Trans-Pacific. And as you write, and I agree with this, but the Trans-Pacific pushes beyond diasporic frameworks, which can reinforce cultural authenticity and logics of a homeland discourse. So can you explain your use of this framework and how it enables your project?
Right. So this kind of links to what we were just talking about with affect, in a way, to think about these methodologies as a way to fold in the so-called others, right? And so the Trans-Pacific scope for me allows us to create critical pathways across more established frameworks of analysis, such as the nation or ethnicity or language, which can oftentimes be exclusionary for folks who are not housed comfortably in them. And so to be clear, I'm not arguing that we should move away from these more institutionalized modes of understanding identity. I just see the potential in the Trans-Pacific scope and stressing the linkages and movements produced when we see national, ethnic, and linguistic particulars are put into contact. So, for instance, my book reads the constant recoding of Chinese-ness as a particularly charged contact zone within Trans-Pacific ideological networks. So with a Trans-Pacific or Oceanic framework, our attention then moves away from the authenticity of national or cultural origins. Since currents are produced collectively and through the process of contact, it emphasizes relationality, basically. And then the book is able then to study not the truth value, per se, of Chinese-ness or originating in any particular location, such as the U.S., China, or Sinophone regions, but more so the affective impact or the cross currents created by these intersecting conceptions of Chinese character.
Your book did help me understand this framework that I also use, because it feels like almost every book that I've read that uses the Trans-Pacific framework does use affect, or does use at least like queer theory, you know, these kind of like studies that are similar to affect studies, sexuality. And that by working in Trans-Pacific, you're kind of, I haven't formulated this into anything yet, but that's not a coincidence, I should say.
No.
And so those two do seem to come together quite often.
Yeah, absolutely.
So since my debut book came out, I've also become so much more aware of the importance of structure to a book. And I think this is something that, like, when you're doing your dissertation, you don't think that much about. Like, you just like, oh, this is just, everything is in historical order, chronological order, so the structure is obvious. But not true at all, right, when you're trying to publish a book. You really have to explain. And so I always, since I went through that, it took me like 5 years to think of a structure for my book. But can you tell us a bit about your book structure? Because you, I mean, it is chronological. So you begin with the early 20th century,
right,
which you call a period of Pacific crossing to the Cold War era, which you name Sinophonic, to a current era of global capitalism. And then each of these different eras offer different representations of Chinese sex workers, but each also builds upon the other. So can you explain your thinking, how you came to the structure, and why you use it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is tied to then our discussion of methodology with the Trans-Pacific and affect together, right? So these are two structures that are that could easily signify everything and nothing at the same time because they're so abstract. And they could easily become very signifiers of very individuated or private modes of expression, right? And so I wanted to make sure that the book had a very strong context to locate the kind of social and material conditions in which these structures are formed. So it's not this wishy-washy, esoteric configuration. Right? I wanted to then understand how these material conditions came about. And so I chose three particular historical junctures in which I thought was particularly interesting because those were moments where world divisions were being drastically reimagined, right? So the first moment being the two world system, the imperialist versus anti-imperialist development in the early 20th century. Second moment being three world system, first, second, third world during the Cold War. And then the last moment being the one world system, the globalization moment that is emphasized in the turn of the 20th century. And so the book is situated in these three moments, but I wanted to make sure that these three historical junctures operated less like distinct signposts than transitory points, that they were able to interact and activate each other, very affective in that sense, right? And so this is also why I wanted to make sure the book spans an extended amount of time and distance, because that extension itself allows us to identify the affective dynamism, right? The relationality between these moments, the relationalities between these cultural productions, these producers, these receivers, these actual figures themselves, to kind of be able to locate the resonating dynamism between these intersecting affective forms across historical moments and geopolitical regions, which, again, the Trans-Pacific allows, because the scope is wider without losing shape in and of itself.
I think you explained it beautifully. I love this word that each era activates the other, right? Each chapter activates the other. I actually started backwards when I was reading it. I read the last chapter first because I'm kind of a fan of one of the movies you talk about in the last chapter.
Right.
So I read that one first, and then I was like, I don't quite get, you know, like some of the concept of dwelling. And then I went back and I read it from the first chapter on, and it suddenly became like, oh, I get it. Like, you have to have all that. Like, if you just wrote about the contemporary era, it would not have been quite as effective. So let's start with that first era then, so we can do a similar climb, I suppose. So the Pacific Crossing, you begin within you call it the Pacific Crossing as a concept, so you can explain that if you want. But here you discuss the literature of Sui Sin Far, who, as well as the on-screen actors who played Chinese prostitutes in China and America. What did you see happening in the representations of sex workers in this era?
Right. So this became a really interesting era because this was the era of both high moments of U.S. and Chinese nation building. And so there was a lot of play of very oppositional concepts of China versus the U.S. So anti-Chinese sentiments, the Page Act, that excluded most female Chinese immigrants into the U.S. under the guise of anti-trafficking, and then also the Chinese Exclusion Acts as well. And then you also, on the other side of the Pacific in China, you see then the rise of these reformists and national revolutions and the May 4th movement and the left-wing cinemas that was kind of in reaction to these kind of yellow peril-esque imperial discourses that frame China and Chineseness as backward and antithetical to modernity. And so I was really drawn to this oppositional framework in this early moment, and how helpful that framework was to articulate a very particular third space, basically, of cultural construction. And what was interesting to me was the figure of the sex worker then becomes extremely pivotal, smack in the middle of this. So just to take the U.S. context, for instance, to be able to articulate a certain kind of benevolent banning of Chinese sex workers or Chinese women as sex workers allowed us to then resolve the paradox between domestic race-based exclusion and kind of international encroachment into Asia with this idea of benevolent civilizational expansion. And so the sex worker as a figure becomes extremely important in both U.S.-based national rhetoric, but also Chinese-based national rhetoric to push back against this kind of encroachment into Asia. What was really interesting for me to look at cultural texts in particular was that you see modes of resistance built into even the cultural text itself. And so what I deem Pacific Crossing is that despite these policies and these very hard forms of power that are constructing this idea of Chinese backwardness, you see these kind of affective formations in cultural production that delineates this third space. And this third space that depends precisely on that opposition, but then actually can transgress it. So for instance, in a lot of in the work of Susan Farr, for instance, you see then the sex worker figure articulating a certain kind of resistance both towards kind of US-based exclusion, but also towards Confucian-based ideas of family at the same time. So these sex workers are able to carve out this third space precisely because of this opposition. This idea of bridging between oppositions creates then that third space of the bridge, which I see kind of constantly recurring, and not only in Susan Farr's work, but also in the Chinatown poets too, and their obsession with articulating a sex worker in Chinatown. And the same thing that you see in national cinemas too, the actresses that play these roles in these nationalistic left-wing cinemas during 1930s Shanghai, although they were supposed to embody national embarrassment and galvanize nationalistic fervor for the anti-imperial deed, they themselves, the way that they are mass mediated, the way that they repackage their bodies, the way that they market their own emotions on and off screen produces something so much more. And that more is what I was interested in, that even in that oppositional structure, there is a certain kind of crossing. That's what I mean by the Pacific Crossing, a certain kind of third space of transgression that can come out of the highly oppositional moment of turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that I love what you say about Suisun Farr too, but I had a kind of aha moment when I was reading the second chapter, which is, mm-hmm. like, as you say, there's a kind of overflow or a kind of excess in the body language of the actresses, mm-hmm. right, who are portraying the sex workers.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of an aha moment for me, because it again gets back to that like crossing of like Trans-Pacific and affect and queer theory, that these are kind of excesses in a sense,
yeah.
you know, that they're not being, they're ways of trying to get out of being tied down by, you know, overflowing the lid, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so I actually went back and rewatched scenes from Shanghai Express just to is their body language really look like that? And I was reading it totally differently after that.
I love that.
Yeah. Because the dialogue is so, you know, like racist in ways, but then just watching Anna May Wong and just the way her body responds to this dialogue, like you can just kind of see that excess, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sense of overflow. So I really appreciate that. So let's talk.
Yeah, that's go ahead. That's what affect can do. That's what I feel like affect is so magical in a way that it kind of allows us different scopes.
That's just,
to
the
me,
stickiness.
I feel is very liberating. Yeah, it's the stickiness that is very generative.
So so let's talk about your second section, which deals with the sex worker in the Cold War era, which and you argue that this begins to carve a kind of Sinophone space. So the third space that you were talking about before, you start to name as more of a Sinophone space here. And it seems loyal to neither America or China or, you know, the ROC or PRC. But like we're saying, has this kind of excess to it. And so you understand how this first kind of starts to emerge in Hong Kong cinema, though it's not really about Hong Kong nationalism at all or anything like that, right? And it comes out with the Shaw Brothers films, and then in Taiwan with Wong Jun-ho's novel, which I once actually reviewed for a magazine when it came out in English, or was re-released in English, Rose, Rose, I Love You, right? About a brothel that ends up serving military servicemen during the Vietnam War. And so I was very curious about these chapters because when I read that book, I love the language in the book, even though it was translated into English, and my Chinese was not good enough, and still is not good enough to read it in Chinese. But the language is just so weird. In English, like mother humper, is one of those words that continually came up. But so let's talk about this section. What do these examples offer? How do they illuminate the ideas and racisms of the period?
What I loved about this era was that this was an era where, if you think about it in the Sinophonic frame, it lends itself a kind of reconstruction outside of the nation state in very creative ways. And I have a historical explanation for that in terms of kind of this era being the moment in which even the project of Chineseness itself was then kind of triangulated through the Cold War, because, you know, China then gets split into the PRC and ROC, and it becomes this huge project in which one claims then authenticity through language, through cultural production, through migration, right? And of course, that split itself is largely mediated through then larger geopolitics with the U.S. and the U.N. itself. So because of this kind of triangulated historical moment, there's some very interesting expressions that then tries to articulate itself in a way that rejects the nation state as the centralizing motivator of identity and social formation. Right? So in the first part, we see then nationalism being very useful in creating this third space. The second moment, when we are completely reconsidering what Chineseness is and what constitutes that region, what is the geopolitics mapped onto it, what are the cultural signifiers, what is the language used to articulate Chineseness, then you suddenly see a huge expansion of space of rethinking identity. And so Shaw Brothers becomes this really interesting formation for me. I remember I started getting very obsessed with them during grad school because I grew up watching their martial arts films, but I had no idea they had such a huge archive of softcore porn. And that was kind of one of their most highly marketed and well-grossed kind of genre. And that's where they get to play a lot outside of the lines, so to say. And another thing that really intrigued me with the Shaw Brothers was also the fact that they were second in production only to Hollywood during a brief moment, 60s and 70s. And so to me, I thought that was very interesting because then they played a huge role in reconstituting what Chineseness looks like across the globe for those that Chinese folks that are in exile, folks that see themselves as a part of the diaspora, folks that are rethinking their own Chineseness in a completely different context. Shaw Brothers then play a huge role in helping kind of constitute a more cohesive language for that. And so looking at kind of a longer genealogy, so in chapter three, I traced in a genealogy of two particular films. One is Ai Nu, Intimate Confessions of a Chinese Courtesan, and then the remake of it 10 years later when the Shaw Brothers was in the decline. And that tracing itself you could see it's a very interesting language of reconstituting a very particular, what I call Sinophonic identity that then doesn't need to queer Chineseness anymore, that it itself can be formulated. So in the first film, you could see it's still trying to deconstruct kind of these social signifiers of Chineseness and Chinese norms. The second remake itself, it really just leaves that all behind. So it moves from a deconstructive to a formulative kind of move and imagining itself on its own terms, which I deem extremely Sinophonic. That it can imagine a minor to minor form of authenticity without falling back on more heteronormative or heterotypical ideas of cultural reproduction. And this kind of ties into the Wang Zhenghe novel too. I love teaching Rose, Rose, I Love You in the classroom. The students are just completely confused and they don't know if they should laugh or they should feel offended. And that's partially what I love about it, because it just kind of, it creates such weird affect too, that it, and the affect goes all directions, right? That you're both disgusted, but at the same time intrigued, and then there's comedic elements to it. And that kind of complication of affect, that kind of splintering it into multi-directions, a huge part is tied to the fact that its language is so layered, right? So even though it's translated into English, right, the translation, I think, was phenomenal, because it really did translate how hard it is to then create a smooth narrative in a land that has so many interlaying languages. And even with a Chinese speaker, right, a native Mandarin speaker reading the original text, if you didn't know Japanese or if you didn't know certain languages like Hokkien, you also would be experiencing very similar experiences as the English-speaking reader as well, because it refuses full-on accessibility. And I think that itself is part of the meaning-making, and what makes this book so interesting is that it kind of puts the reader in place and also makes the reader feel the kind of different hierarchies of language clashing, and then produces this kind of multi-directionality of meaning-making and affective attachments at the same time. And of course, the sex worker is just smack in the middle of it. Right? So the people that are kind of contesting authoritarian language, the people that are contesting official Mandarin use of Chinese, these are all the sex workers just really coming in and clamoring. And this is where I see the fourth chapter really leading into the last section, is that I feel that the novel not only articulates this decentering of nation state as this centralized idea of identity formation, it actually projects a certain kind of outwardness. It calls the reader to train yourself to have a better year, to listen to the clamor of voices that is inherently minor transnational, right? That these voices are not in one location. They're not singular. They don't go in one direction. Oftentimes they're misspoken. And so it needs a more creative idea of understanding minor to minor communication and minor to minor connection. And so I see that's kind of where the second part moves into the third, which really looks at post-Cold War, how do we deal with this one worldness without then being completely taken over by a dominant narrative of neoliberal cohesion or globalized marketization.
Yeah, so let's get to that that last section. And one other thing I wanted to mention that I really appreciate about these last couple chapters, though, is like you said, they train the ear into hearing these things, but they're also so based on parody, which is it feels so rare in the Western world to have, especially when dealing with like sex work, or like desire for the other. And like, so if we have any good readers out there, Rose, Rose, I Love You, I still think is like incomparable as a novel.
I teach it every year. It is amazing.
Now I'm tempted to teach it, but
it is challenging, but it is quite rewarding.
Okay, so let's get to your last section then, where you do talk about another text that I love, which is a Seeking Asian Female,
right?
Which I teach in class every year, and it's similar to the others in that it's also really funny.
Yeah.
But it's a documentary, and so it's not really, it's not clear if it's supposed to be originally made for that purpose.
Right.
It becomes funny because of the antics, I suppose, that are being recorded. Right. So you compare, so this is Seeking Asian Female, right, is about a kind of mail order bride story. But the white male husband is just so open and has no filter. So you just see everything laid out on the table of what he thinks of Asian women. And there's also a relief in that, right? In that he's not trying to hide, whereas everyone else feels like you're trying to hide all of these ways of thinking. And so you compare this with a Taiwanese film, The Fourth Portrait, which I have not seen. So I'll trust you to maybe talk a bit more about that. But one thing I love about this section is that especially Seeking Asian Female is not usually seen as a kind of sex worker film, right?
Yeah. And,
so you have to expand that term a bit, but you also show how, you know, any relationship has these like exchanges in it. And so that there is something about kind of decentering like the prostitute proper from sex work that allows us to kind of visualize how we've come to rely so much on this specific figure, right? And villainize the specific figure. So I'll leave it to you to make any entry point you want into this last section. There's so many.
This was the section that I did, like you said, expand the scope a little bit from kind of sex work, talking about prostitution in particular, to then larger ideas of sex work, the work or the labor of mobilizing sex or desire or management of desires as itself a form of labor. So this is where it kind of expands itself into larger ideas of affective labor. And I see that kind of larger forms of affective labor becoming extremely important in the turn of the 20th century, where people often call kind of a neoliberal moment or a globalizing moment, right? Where then we're kind of increasingly tied to information and more softer forms of labor. And so this is why I kind of at first it started as an experiment to pair these two films, because they don't seem like they have direct connections. But in a way, I wanted to connect them through this idea of a larger concept of affective labor, but also how the marriage institution itself is also oftentimes tied to a lot of these marketized exchanges. So both of these films' main heroines are mainland Chinese women who exchange their global mobility, the first woman in the Fourth Portrait going to Taiwan, and then the second woman going to the U.S., both of them exchanging their global mobility through then marketing themselves as Blacks, right? So they were able to then move out of China to Taiwan and the U.S. Through then marrying themselves out. And what was interesting to me was that instead of seeing them as solely kind of victims of marketized pressures to then go to other places, these women had so much agency on their own terms. And what I saw was a certain kind of recursive repackaging or recycling of the signifier of Chinese-ness, that it can be repackaged through their own bodies to articulate a certain kind of agency that actually refuses both kind of an articulation of national patriotism to the places that they go to, right? So both heroines do not actually completely subscribe to their host nations, Taiwan or the U.S. They also do not subscribe to certain kind of expectations of their marriage labor, right? Like reproduction or domestic work. And so I was very interested in how that was mobilized through the film itself. And so this is why Dwelling became really interesting. If we think about marketized exchanges, marketing a lot of kind of hyperconnectivity and upward mobility of capital, Dwelling then becomes a different kind of motion. It's recursive, and every recursive movement itself, it reconstitutes and reorients a possibility. And that's kind of the affect structure that I see these heroines, these female women in these in the films doing, is that they kind of repackage in a recursive way their own agency that defies both marketized exchanges but also nationalistic patriotism at the same time.
Yeah, one of my my favorite examples of dwelling is actually in your conclusion. Mm-hmm. When you give examples of like online communities who are sympathetic to sex workers and are talking about pop music from the beginning, and then they're kind of translating for each other and they're having this dialogue when they're really kind of supposed to hate each other, otherwise. But they're dwelling in this virtual space, and that was another kind of moment for me where I was like, okay, I get dwelling in this sense because. And I had to compare it in my mind to like settling, where like in Seeking Asian Female, the heroine refuses to kind of settle in the U.S., she doesn't allow herself to pretend that the U.S. is so great or any of that stuff. She's very much thinking about both.
Exactly.
And so once I made that comparison, I thought, okay, I get it. And then the second thing that made me get it, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in the first part of you were talking about third space, but then you start to use the word sinophonic in the second section. Mm-hmm. And what I like about dwelling here is it does seem to name a kind of affectively like driven third space, but not one that you can name as such. You can't really name it, especially in the contemporary moment, right? We don't know what it's going to yield.
Yes.
So, can you talk a bit more about dwelling, how you use it, it could be on a virtual sort of dwelling?
Right. I love kind of your reading just now about how it's very hard to name, right? That in comparison then to the first and second part, dwelling, it becomes this kind of more emergent form. And that's what I actually really love about looking at affect, is that you get to kind of see or trace things on the cusp of materializing as well. And I do think that with the dwelling moments, I'm basically trying them to think through the contemporary. And I do feel like it is in the process of formulating. And so this is kind of going to be where my second book starts off, right? So the first book kind of ends with this kind of initial formation, this idea of recursive actualization that defies kind of marketized exchanges, but hasn't quite yet materialized, at least in the way that I'm thinking yet. And so becomes this launching point, I think, of kind of what is to come. But I do think it is really interesting to think about other possibilities, to think through this kind of contemporary neoliberal moment that defies a dichotomy between resistance versus accommodation. There is this kind of third space that is a little bit more volatile. And I'm trying to think through that. And that's kind of where the first book ends and where the second book will start off.
That's fabulous. So I'll ask you a bit more about that second book in a minute. But let's finish this one first. I have one more question.
Absolutely.
About this project, which is... how you see it making an impact in other discourses, even in perhaps on the ground kind of impact. You have so many ideas going on, and this is also like historical. It's embedded in affect theory and Sinophone studies, China studies, Asian American studies. How do you see this work? You're kind of carving your own third space in a way. How do you see this then affecting other fields?
I think this is also kind of a result of coming through a comparative literature degree, right? So Complet and Inherently is training us to think at the intersections or trying to figure out synergies between fields. And that has been very life-giving for me. And where I think, and I guess I hope the book intervenes in are two general areas. One is in its trans-Pacific scope, and the other is in its affective methodology. And so the first trans-Pacific scope, I hope that, like we talked about a little bit earlier, that it complicates, of course, the diasporic framework, right? That to think beyond centripetal ideas of cultural authenticity and homeland discourse, which is oftentimes exclusionary for folks that are not comfortably housed. the book, The Trans-Pacific Scope, also serves as an interesting counterpoint to really rich scholarship on transatlantic studies. I think it's an emerging field that is able to highlight the understudied yet vital role the Asia-Pacific has played in shaping what we consider to be the global. And I think it's only going to be more and more important as, you know, U.S. foreign policy pivots to Asia and so on and so forth. So I think the first intervention, I hope, is to kind of further articulate and expand the field that might be called Trans-Pacific Studies. It could be a field, it could be a methodology. It really depends on how folks want to approach it, right? I really don't want it to be a descriptor. I really hope that it is kind of an instigator as a sense of analytical scale. And the other intervention that I hope my work is working towards is affect. And so I feel like an affective analysis challenges the privatization of identity politics, since affect itself produces relationality, right? That it needs to hinge on the friction between bodies. Something as individuated as folks' understandings of their own bodies and desires are under an affective lens deprivatized as historically situated notions. And so, for instance, a focus on affective labor, such as sex work, then contextualizes identity within larger social and material relations. And so if we think about affective labor becoming increasingly significant in, let's say, a late capitalist economy, it seems then crucial for us to develop ways to locate complex workings of affect, value, and power that we see through old and new styles of economic, technological, and cultural forms. And so I really hope that Trans-Pacific Attachment offers such a study or starts a conversation in this direction.
Fabulous. Sounds like a lot to take on. I'm going to ask now about your future projects, but I should probably shout out that we're going to be on a panel together in November at the American Studies Association conference in Atlanta, Georgia. I totally forgot to plug this. so we'll be there, and Martin Joseph Ponce is chairing. We'll have Amy Bong also on the panel, and Gina Valesco also on the panel. So come up for that if you're at ASA. So besides this panel, what else do you have going on? What's your next project after this?
So the next project really starts off where the first project ends off, in terms of time period, but also analytical scope. It's tentatively titled Liaisons and Alliances, Trans-Pacific Crossings in Neoliberal Order. And the project furthers the book's attention to culture, politics of affect and motion. It starts with the dwelling, right? And to think through this particular contemporary moment, but to focus mainly on minor transnational connections. So transborder links and collaborations across minority networks, so alliances that could potentially be created. So one of the first chapters, for instance, this was published in American Quarterly last year, was a reading of Yamashita's I Hotel, and thinking through kind of 60s and 70s Asian American movement politics as it reimagines Chinese social movements like May 4th and the Cultural Revolution, and revitalizing a certain kind of, let's say, anti-capital politics. So I'm really interested in that, not only in terms of this going back to the dwelling, like what is generative and going back? What is generative and recycling? What is generative and not fully using, right? Not fully capitalizing? And so I felt like I Hotel was just such a brilliant novel, and I really wanted to write about the intersection between kind of third world politics during the 60s and 70s, China's revolution, Maoism, and the Asian American politics.
Wow. So what was the going title, Liaisons?
Liaisons and Alliances, Trans-Pacific Crossings and Neoliberal Order.
Okay, fabulous. So if the listener is listening to this 2, 3, maybe 5 years, who knows from now, it might already be out.
it could be a completely different title.
Or, yeah, completely different. And have completely different contents, too.
Exactly.
As we know. Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been my pleasure reading your book and interviewing you. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this interview with Lily Wong on her new book, Trans-Pacific Attachments, Sex Work, Media Networks, and Effective Histories of Chineseness. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, you can contact us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks for listening.